In a couple of months, the wheat fields in Kansas will sound a lot like this. Stalks waving in the wind and ready for harvest. But the way we use land for agriculture is slowly stripping it of its richness and nutrients. That's something Wes Jackson has been telling us since before it was popular. In fact, since 1976, the founder of the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, has been speaking out against what he calls the 10,000-year-old problem of agriculture. The plowshare, he writes, may well have destroyed more options for future generations than the sword. But his relationship with farmland goes back even further than that. It started when he was just a kid in the 1940s. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, as Wes Jackson prepares to retire from the Land Institute, we'll hear his story. It's a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. Wes Jackson, good morning.
Good morning.
What did you mean when you said that the plowshare may well have destroyed more options for future generations than the sword?
Well, the plowshare is what is used to turn over a vegetative structure that has been millions of years in the making. In the case, if you're the breaking of prairie, or you're cutting the forest and then you're plowing, you are destroying relationships that have evolved over those millions of years.
What kinds of relationships?
Well, if you think about what we'll call an ecosystem, like a prairie, there is the above-ground diversity that features perennial plants, that is, plants that just came coming up every year. There'll be a few annuals mixed in there, but most of the vegetation is perennial. Below that surface is a diversity of roots, and not only that, a diversity of microbes, bacteria, fungi, invertebrates, and so on. And so here you have a system in which there are efficiencies that are inherent within those natural integrities, the integration over time in which a balance, what we might call balance of nature, has evolved. So when we started agriculture some 10 to 12,000 years ago at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, the ice has been retreating, and there, the annual grains were, the wheat was discovered and planted out, and it required tearing up those original relationships in order to for us to have grain. So it's the human has been around with the big brain 150 to 200,000 years. All but about 5% of that time we've been gatherers and hunters. So we started agriculture, and it required living with the idea that nature is to be subdued or ignored if we're going to eat.
Now, you aren't talking about, I just want to clarify, a specific approach to agriculture. You are just talking about agriculture.
I'm talking about grain agriculture featuring perennials, well, featuring annuals.
So, and I also want to address, you don't just write about changes to the land that have come as part of agriculture, and especially recently with agriculture. You write about changing communities, the loss of small towns.
I do. And that within the agricultural context of, say, the last 10,000 years, agriculture has required a sufficiency of people on the land, primarily engaged in weed management, pulling weeds, hoeing weeds, and so on. And those cultural relationships, the agriculture, has been the way we have done it until the industrial era. And then with the industrialization of agriculture, what we began to do is substitute the fossil fuels. And we use fossil fuels to make fertilizer, to make pesticides, to run our tractors. That's contributed to climate change, by the way. And it has also led to chemicals being put out there in the world that our tissues have not evolved with. In the case of the nitrogen fertilizer, the anhydrous ammonia applied to our fields, the annual grain systems leak, and those they go down to New Orleans, and the nitrogen down to New Orleans and the Gulf. And along with that, the people that were on the land using their energy and their knowledge could not compete with the so-called efficiencies that come from fossil fuels replacing those evolved relationships. So this is an information-intensive system went away to the cities as it was being replaced by highly dense carbon.
So why do small towns matter to you? I mean, what is it that you think is important to preserve about them, about those communities?
Well, I look back at the way the human brain, our bodies, our hands, and so on have evolved over that, well, we'll say 150, 200,000 years. And we're tribal. We were tribal before that. And so a lot of the what we might call unconscious relationships that have to do with mental health as well as physical health are tied to a kind of a basic tribal kind of phenomenon. When we got into agriculture and developed village life, then a lot of that was a continuation of that ancient relationship. Well, we've increasingly become a species out of context, out of the context that shaped us. And then we are forced into dealing with everything from mental health to physical health to whatever. Well, I saw the small towns and the rural communities as sort of the, you know, the last holdout for something closer to an original relationship to the universe.
Where, how do you think a sense of place fits into all of this? Because for city people like myself, a sense of place has to do with an urban grid and familiar structures made out of brick or concrete or what have you, as well as like places of business that exist within those structures, restaurants where they serve iconic foods or places we went with our parents or grandparents. There are places in Kansas City that are etched as deeply into my internal map as they are onto maps that people use to navigate the physical city. And I wonder, for people who come from the communities you just described, is land the equivalent?
I don't think so. And I'm not very good at being a critique of cities. I like to go there now and then. But let's think of it this way. Aldo Leopold in San Calme Almanac said, there are two spiritual dangers that come from not owning a farm. He could just as well say growing up on a farm. One is the belief that heat comes from the stove. The other is that, let's see, heat comes from a stove. And what was the other?
I think that breakfast comes.
Breakfast comes from a grocery store. To not be aware of our source is a kind of dumbness, a sort of illiteracy. And then we are far less likely to practice what in the past is considered ordinary frugality. Milton talked about nature as the good cateress that will meet our needs, the needs of those who live according to the holy dictate of spare temperance. And I find in cities that because of the disassociation from that connection to the land, the holy dictate of spare temperance is not really there.
Well, so looking and with agriculture itself and grain agriculture in particular, perennial grain agriculture being also problematic for you, you've been quoted as saying that, you know, we shouldn't try to improve on this patch of native prairie. It seems like the prairie is really the gold standard for you.
Right. That is. That is, you know, the prairies of at least of Kansas were what were there during all interglacial periods of the Pleistocene. That is the vegetation that returned. And so that's not true up in, say, in Iowa, where a lot of woods came during the interglacial periods. But that's nature's ecosystems become the standard. We have to ask ourselves, what is the standard for humanity's future food production? And the standard where there's tight nutrient cycling, run on contemporary sunlight, taking advantage of information-intensive systems. And when we talk about all those burrowing creatures and the creatures above the surface as well, you know, that's information. When you erase that with the plow, then what we have done is simplify that system. And when you simplify something, it has a tendency to become simplifying. And so your worldview becomes simplified to the point that we simply live for pleasure rather than a kind of a responsible engagement with the world, which sustains us. So Start there.
Is it the complexity of the prairie then that makes it the gold standard for you, or something else too?
Well, it's the complexity and the symbiotic engagement of the various life forms with the physicality of that prairie.
When and how did you fall in love with the prairie and everything it represents?
Well, you know, I don't think I fell in love immediately. You may have a certain high charge when you see the beauty of a prairie, but when I was the summer I became 16, I went and worked on a ranch in South Dakota. And I had been working on our family had a truck farm in the Kansas River Valley near Topeka. And that was, you know, growing up on the end of a hoe handle, what that was. But up on that prairie, which not too many generations before in South Dakota, was the Native American that was living on the bison. And what we settlers did was get rid of the red man, get rid of the bison, and put on the domestic bovine on that prairie, which there was a system that was the tragedy associated with effectively the genocide of the native, notwithstanding, the not at all trivial. But here was something of a relationship to land that was more like our original relationship to the world than the one in the Kansas River Valley.
It still was when you went there as a 16-year-old?
I think that's right. It was, and I went there as a 16-year-old. I think that was the first fix on prairie. And then later I took my students on a field trip to the Konza Prairie. And
In Kansas,
yeah. And then it was there that I began to think, you know, here is a system that doesn't require fossil fuel. We're not applying chemicals that we've not evolved with. And here there's no soil erosion beyond sort of natural replacement levels, you know, here. And yet all around was the corn, the soybeans, the wheat, and so on, all the ecological capital headed toward the sea. And I didn't know it at the time, but land use globally is number two as a source of greenhouse gases, behind power plants and ahead of all transportation. So almost everything we do with modern agriculture industrial-type agriculture is wrong. Now, I'm not blaming farmers. I'm talking about a context. Farmers can't do anything about this, but what then set me off was to begin to build an agriculture based on the way natural ecosystems work, and then that meant perennials grown in mixtures, and so we're mostly plant breeders at the land, a little bit of ecology and soil science also going on.
You say the land, you mean the Land Institute?
Yeah, the Land Institute.
So when you founded the Land Institute in 1976, like right before that, you had just gotten tenure as a professor at Cal State in Sacramento.
Yeah.
What were you teaching? What was your area of specialization? You talked about field trips and so forth.
Well, they had hired me to start the environmental studies program there, and I had done a book. It was an anthology called Man and the Environment. Only two things wrong with that title, Man and Environment. But
what's wrong with those?
Well, we know what's wrong with. First of all, most farmers of the world are women. And so what man stood for, humanity in those days. And environment is really not a very good word.
Why not?
Well, where is it? Where in the world is environment? It is a kind of a part of that subject-object dualism as something out there. And then we do something for the environment, like doing something for a homeless person or something.
Right, whereas my environment right now is a radio studio.
Yeah, well, see, in fact, we're starting at the land. We've been at it for about a year now. An ecosphere studies program. And I am retiring as president, but I'm not retiring as a part of the membership of the land. But if you think of an ecosphere, first of all, the physicality of the early Earth gave rise to organisms. And then organisms interacting with that physicality gave us the world we have now. It beats us in inclusiveness. It is also creative, giving rise to new species. And so it's better, I think, for us to think about us being embedded within an ecosphere. I mean, one way to look at it, imagine that we were to look into a cell and we could make ourselves small enough to move around in a cell. We would see some things like crystals that weren't moving. We'd see other things that were dynamic. And so there's the physicality there and there is the movement there, but you step outside the cell and you see the whole thing is alive.
I wonder what happened in 1976 that made you give up your coveted tenured professorship to start a movement of sorts in Salina, Kansas. I mean, I'm guessing life was pretty good in California.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm a Kansan. I'm a prairie belly, I guess. And my wife and I wanted our children to grow up in a context of coming to terms with source. So it was kind of a beginning. Was actually 74 that we moved back. Land Institute started in 76. And, you know, we had the milk cow, we had the butcher hog, we had the beef, we had the big garden. I was wanting us to see what is involved in trying to run a homestead on contemporary sunlight. And, you know, we still had the car and we still had the pickup truck and I had a small tractor and so on. But I wanted them to, become connected to the world. And then I was actually on leave. And so I had to either resign or whatever. So, John Simpson, who was a Kansas legislator then in the Senate, now lives in Kansas City, Missouri. John Simpson said, if you want to start a school, I'll help you. And so he gave us a little bit of money, $4,000 or $5,000, and another friend did, and that's what set us off.
So what was We'll get back to the Land Institute and how you built it, what it stands for. But I want to talk about your upbringing, because it sounds like connecting your own children to something closer to the kind of upbringing you had was important to you. Where exactly was the farm where you grew up, and what was it like there?
Well, it was technically called Route 6, North Topeka, Kansas, but it was in the Kansas River Valley. I went to Seaman Rural High School. And it was a kind of a highly diverse farm, some 27 species on that farm, because some pretty good data was taken on the crops. You know, we had watermelon, sweet potatoes, cantaloupes. We also had cattle, hogs, chickens, turkeys. We grew most of our own food. We had draft animals. And then during the war, got a tractor. I was the last of six, and I had two brothers.
The war being World War II?
Yeah. I had two brothers that were both in the Pacific at the time. And, you know, my oldest sister is 22 years older than I. You know, my next oldest is 8 years older. It's really strung them out there. So it was the most highly diverse farm that I've ever come across.
What did you do on the farm? You said you grew up on the back of a plow handle?
On the end of a hoe handle.
Hoe handle,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, you got a lot of truck crops. You know, I mentioned watermelon, sweet potatoes, cantaloupes, peonies, strawberries. We had up to 15 acres of strawberries. And not only were they for picking, but you would go out and dig them and sell the roots and so on. So it was, and of course the market was in Topeka for a lot of that.
Do you have any formative farm memories from your childhood, like scenes that you go back to in your mind that might have begun to form your views on land and community without your even knowing it at the time?
Well, what I know is that, and I've used this example many times, if there was a fried egg, half of it maybe cut off and eaten, the other half would be put into the refrigerator to mix and form, you know, it'd be mixed with something the next go round, or maybe a day or two later. You didn't throw food away, and we were the parents were living according to the holy dictate of spare temperance. There's plenty if we'll practice the frugality, and so that's still strong in me. When I see how much food goes back on plates when I go to a restaurant, and it's a rather blasé idea. It's quite all right to just dump it. And now where that comes from has to do with, I think, having been a part of a food production.
You know, a lot of people who grew up on farms feel very nostalgic about that experience, and it sounds like you have a real fondness for this lifestyle on many levels, but yet this critique of the founding principles of agriculture on some level. Do you have trouble reconciling that personally?
I have trouble reconciling almost all my life, quite frankly. I mean, you know, I get in a pickup truck and I drive to Kansas City from Salina. Yesterday, and I'll turn around and go back. I'm going to spend a lot of highly dense carbon for this trip. This is the problem. We're all caught within this system. Now, look, I'm glad to be alive. If it had not been for penicillin way back when I was a kid, I wouldn't be here now. If it hadn't been for a lot of the modern accoutrements of civilization, I wouldn't be here. Now, you know, that said, that does not mean that it has not come at a cost.
KCUR Central Standard has to take a short break, but we'll get right back to our portrait session with legendary agricultural thinker Wes Jackson, who founded the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas in 1976. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Thank you. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Wes Jackson, a big name in sustainable agriculture. But when he founded the Land Institute in 1976, small-scale agriculture wasn't something people talked about. Getting back to the land was a movement. But Wes, where would you say that culture was when it came to thinking about land and land use in 1976?
Where was the culture? What was the culture thinking about? I think the culture was beginning to realize. there were some of the more extreme members of the culture that were looking about getting back on the land, and not as a matter of mere nostalgia, but as a practical necessity. And having a meaningful relationship with the earth, that the industrial mind was still reigning. The industrial mind has continued to reign. But there were a few. And that, by the way, is growing. I mean, I've been to a lot of places, coast to coast, and there are a lot of folk that are, it's interesting, met in some pretty expensive colleges,
yeah.
Have some rather large college debt, and yet there they are out there in their little plots doing local organic community-supported type agriculture. Now, our work at the Land Institute, while we endorse those folks as a kind of important core constituency, that's going to be necessary when the new paradigm for agriculture becomes the one that we're working on at the land to develop perennial grain polycultures that mimic the prairie. We're going to need those folks as part of the constituency. You know, they understand. But the world has become, I think, increasingly uncertain about how much longer this can go on.
This being the way we predominantly practice agriculture.
Yeah, well, and not only practice agriculture, how we live in the world. I mean, whether we're talking about power plants or transportation or climate change, we know at some deep level that this is ephemeral. And I think it's clear that, you know, with 150 years, there's going to be, you know, a serious, serious questioning of the Industrial Revolution generally, and that we're going to be looking to an ecological worldview. And so, therefore, I think there's another purpose for our work at the land. For instance, we're looking to the prairie as a real economy. There's nothing phony about that economy.
What do you mean?
Well, there is actually economics and ecology have a common root, common Greek root. And when you look out on that prairie, you are seeing a system that recycles materials, runs on contemporary sunlight, does not have soil erosion. The stuff that organisms are made of is not running toward the sea. It is a system that has evolved. You know, well, organisms began on the earth some like 3.45 billion years ago. And we have there's something like 800 million years ago that we get multicellular life. And we then have the land animals and so on.
Land animals, including humans. I'm curious about where you think humans fit into this ecology and economy, because when you talk about nature as kind of a measure or model for sustainability, what about human nature?
Well, human nature is, look, let me put it this way. All organisms are carbon-based. And therefore, and that starts 3.45 billion years ago, all animal organisms go after carbon. So whether it's bacteria on a petri dish with sugar, they just grow. Drosophila flies in a flask with bananas, which is carbon, and yeast, carbon. They just grow. Deer without predators, They just grow. And so humans are very clever, and we have created economic systems that to grow. We have a growth mentality. Well, growth is the etiology of the cancer cell, and growth without restriction is destructive. So what we have is an economic system that's like bacteria on a petri dish. Now, every now and then we get concerned about social justice, and we will put in legislation so that we can all hit the edge of the petri dish at the same time. So we humans are, as land animals, are living according to the same laws and rules of the ancient ecosystems.
So do you think that humans would ever go back to some other system without, I mean, I know that the answer might be that we may have to, but without having reached that critical point where continuing to, as you might say, deceive ourselves is no longer possible, do you think that people would just change path and go against that growth model?
Well, I'm not optimistic, but I am hopeful. And I have reason to be hopeful because of some good examples that are going on now. What we're really talking about is moving from an industrial worldview to ecology worldview. And if we can practice restraint, and I see the practicing of restraint would be to put a cap on highly dense carbon, coal, oil, natural gas, and then reduce that cap, and then see how good our technology can be. You know, I have friends that work to develop efficient technologies, you know, squiggly light bulbs and Priuses and so on. But you know, there's an important it's important to appreciate that humans have to be the first species that practices restraint. No other species has had to do it. If deer don't do it in the absence of predators, their numbers just go up until, you know, there's starvation. You know, there's a man by the name of William Stanley Jevons in 1865. He did a book called The Coal Question. That's a result of a lot of research he had done. Now, this is over 100 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. William Stanley Jevons found that as humans became more efficient in their technology, they used more resources, particularly coal and iron. In other words, it frees up capital. So if we can acknowledge Jevons' paradox, practice restraint in the use of the carbon, and quit making as our current god growth, we've got to stop growth, go negative, and that means we've got to figure out a different way to live. And I think that conversation is now underway. This is what makes me hopeful. It's not just among intellectuals this conversation is going. It's going on. Right now, there are 10,000 of these discussions going on at this moment across this country and in Europe.
When you started the Land Institute in 1976, was getting to that place where that conversation is happening, was that your goal? Can you describe to me your vision at the time when you started the Land Institute?
Well, the vision was that we need a sustainable agriculture and culture. And that I think a friend of mine put it this way. If we don't get sustainability in agriculture first, it's not going to happen. Agriculture ultimately has a discipline standing behind it called ecology and evolutionary biology. The industrial sector, the material sector, has no discipline standing behind it. A discipline of how systems work in the way of renewability.
So you had this very conceptual, philosophical idea, a scientific goals that accompanied it. How did those goals and those ideas translate to, like, on the ground, you've come back to Kansas, you've stopped being a professor. Can you walk me through what that was like for you really personally?
Well, I did it with a lot of doubt, especially in the middle of the night, when you think, my golly, can we do this? Because the general, my beginning point was try to get sustainability in agriculture first, because if we can keep our food supply assured, we can get through this long, dark tunnel of transformation in which we work to end population growth as we end economic growth and start living within our means. And so in thinking it through, then, of course, what I can do, my background's in genetics, least what I can do is, first of all, try to get sustainability in agriculture. And so that we can stop soil erosion, stop putting chemicals out there we haven't evolved with, reduce the fossil fuel dependency and get that to zero. Build an agriculture as sustainable as nature's ecosystems that we've destroyed.
In coming back to Kansas to do this, did you find Kansas to be a hospitable place for this work?
Well, not particularly. But look, there were other things. I had been marginally as a graduate student in Raleigh, North Carolina State in Raleigh, is where I did the PhD in genetics. And, I went to hear Martin Luther King. I was concerned about the civil rights movement, although I was not what you would call really active because I was busy as a graduate student. But then there was the Vietnam War. And I began to realize that war and racism and poverty and the growing gap between the rich and the poor was all a part of one package. And part of that package had to do with the way we opened up this continent. And Wendell Berry's book, 1977 book, a very great book, The Unsettling of America, which, by the way, was a critique of agriculture as we know it. It had to do with culture and agriculture as, sort of one subject. So the war, the racism, the poverty, Wendell Berry's book, which is a year after we started the Land Institute, and then that conversation between Wendell and me, which goes on about every week.
And it goes on in your books, too, in the introductions.
Oh, yeah. Well,
often.
Wendell's my guru. And there's another guru, actually, he's dead now, and that's J. Stan Rowe. And I got actually a lot of gurus. I mean, I really frequently say I don't have a mind of my own.
But can we get back to this question of how hospitable Kansas was or was not? You said not particularly, and I'm curious about how you experienced that. I mean, what exactly did you experience in Kansas as you were trying to get this going?
Well, look, I being a rural Kansas farm boy myself, I wasn't surprised at what kind of conversations might be had at the coffee shops throughout, not just rural Kansas, rural America.
Were they?
Well, like, man, this is crazy. And what's he mean, the problem of agriculture? They took that personally. They're used to dealing with problems in agriculture. That's what the land-grant universities are all about. And I'm a product of one of those land-grant universities. North Carolina State's a land-grant college. I knew what kind of conversations were going on. But number one, I've never once criticized a single farmer. I've never once told another farmer how he or she should be farming. If my next-door neighbor asks me, I don't give any advice. But what I'm critiquing is the whole problem of agriculture, not those that are caught within the system.
Wes Jackson, can you stay with me through one last break this morning?
I hope so.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we have just a few minutes left of this portrait session with the Land Institute's Wes Jackson when KCUR's Central Standard returns. Be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman and Wes Jackson of the Land Institute is the subject of this morning's portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. Our portrait sessions are in-depth conversations with the most interesting people in and around Kansas City, paired with photographic portraits by the talented Paula Andrews. You can see Paul's photos of Wes at kcur.org/centralstandard. We've heard how Wes got his start in life on a Kansas farm near Topeka, and how in 1976 he gave up a tenured professorship at Cal State to come back to Kansas and start the Land Institute, where some say he also started a movement. But Wes, how did that upbringing on a Kansas farm affect you in other ways? I'm thinking about whether that might be where your scientific curiosity was ingrained in you, because you mentioned you are, by training and education, a geneticist.
Yes. Well, it's hard to know. Many times I've tried to answer that question, and I'll give what sounds like a wonderfully coherent story, and I get back and think, that ain't it. And then I'll get another run at it, and then I think, that ain't it. And so I don't totally trust, first of all, my memory. There are just too many converging variables, too many people, too many books to have read and articles to have read.
But if you had to tell a story today, what would it be?
Of how I got into all of this.
How you got interested in science especially.
Well, I don't know. I think actually genetics was the natural field for me, because growing up on a farm where you have cattle, hogs, chickens, and breeding is going on, and you see heredity at work and plants at work. A genetic, and also I'm interested in, you know, the grandparents that I've never met and the great grandparents I've never met, and you know, where did we all come from? And so we're all derivatives of both our heredity and environment. And it's, in the long run, it's not heredity and it's not environment, it's the interaction. And so it's those interactions that are very hard to pin down.
But how did you witness that on the farm growing up?
Well, if you're on the farm, you are connected to the source, and then your sense of oughtness. I mean, why is it, for instance, that when I came home from school, didn't matter if I had been out for football or not, there was work to do. There are the cows that had to be milked, and the next morning the cows had to be milked, and the animals fed, and so on. You weren't, and this is one of the things that amazes me, you know, that the very fields that I worked in are now soccer fields. And nobody worried about getting exercise. You were getting exercise as you did your work. And so it still strikes me as odd that we are unwilling to work in the fields, but we're willing to go to a gym. You know, I mean, I just, it doesn't
taking the elevator, then going on the stair stepper.
Yeah, it doesn't compute, you see. So, but when you are connected to the source, and then your moral code develops around that. I was raised in a Methodist family. I tell people they're still Methodist in my madness. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, the Methodists have a way. The way, you know, John Wesley,
the founder of Methodism.
And by the way, my full name is Sharon, which is biblical, Wesley, which is denominational, Jackson, which is secular. I got that covered there. I go obviously by the middle name Wes, but you are surrounded by the language of the Bible, the language of responsibility that's necessary if you are to sustain your homestead.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because we were talking before the break about how the people around you in rural Kansas, when you founded the Land Institute, that there was some talk that maybe came from taking it personally, your sort of larger critique of agriculture writ large. But I wonder how much of that comes from some of the ideas about agriculture and the religious communities that often surround agriculture in America have to do with good stewardship. And people have grown up, I mean, generations, believing that their work is good stewardship. Yeah. Stewardship.
Sure. Well, yes, I mean, every farmer really wants to be a good steward of the land. It's just the context with which in he or she finds him or herself, it is, it's difficult. I somewhat liken it to this. You know about the Stockholm Syndrome and Patty Hearst?
I do, but why don't you refresh my memory, just
well,
in case?
The Patty Hearst was captured by the Limbanee Liberation Army, and she was William Randolph Hearst, or whatever his name was, daughter, the founder of a newspaper in California. And she was captured, and her name was changed to Tanya, and she was photographed holding a weapon. She got out of that with the argument that, which was the argument used on the Stockholm Syndrome, that the only way she could survive was to have joined the opposing forces. Now, in a way, we're all Patty Hearst. We are caught within the context of a system, and the only way we are able to survive is to be a part of that membership. Now, I think that's one thing, to be caught within it.
Who are our captors? Because Stockholm Syndrome is where you sort of begin to sympathize and side with and become kind of one with your captors.
Right. That's right.
Who are the world's captors?
Well, the world's captors are an economic system that has evolved over time and to accommodate an agricultural system that we are dependent upon. But it's one thing to be a captive in it and to not be aware, and it's another thing to be a captive in it and to be aware.
You know, I have what I think are lofty goals in my work and often fall short. And, you know, I'm struck by the scale of what you have been trying to do in your career and wondering if you have ever felt overwhelmed or just defeated, even temporarily.
Well, sure. But look, what are we going to do? If we're to have hope, we have to be able to critique our world, critique what we are caught up in. What I know is that, yes, it's important to have the good examples, but look, this is why it has to go beyond agriculture, because if, let's say, we're successful, and I think we will be, at getting herbaceous as opposed to woody, perennial, seed-producing polycultures mimicking the prairie, to presume that we can have that as a satellite to safely orbit the extractive economy would be naive. We've got to talk about overall cultural transformation. And if we can get, though, the sustainability in agriculture and then use that as a kind of a prototype, as a new source of metaphors for how we're going to organize society in general, I think we can get beyond the industrial mind.
It's interesting to me that you see metaphors as the first step, changing our metaphors. What are our metaphors now, and what do they, in your view, need to be?
Well, the metaphors that we draw on are almost all mechanical. They will talk about leveraging your assets. We will use language that comes out of the Industrial Revolution rather than the language that comes out of nature.
So using nature metaphors is our first step in changing as humanity?
I think we've got to think about the possibility of a creaturely life. And then, for instance, the so-called Green Revolution was for the purpose of the advancement of industry.
Wes Jackson of the Land Institute, that's all the time we have this morning. You're a rare case of an hour not quite being enough. Thank you so much for making that trip to the city in your pickup truck.
Yeah, well, my pleasure.
And good luck with your retirement as president of the Land Institute.
Yes, I'm still on duty.
Okay. Wes Jackson founded the Land Institute in 1976. You can listen back to this discussion or share it with a friend at kcur.org/centralstandard. And that's also where you'll see photos of Wes taken by photographer Paul Andrews. While you're there, you can sign up for our podcast. That way you can listen to Central Standard while you're maybe hiking in the Kansas prairie. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays by Jen Chen. We get help from Coy Duggar and Glenn Frizzell. Linda Scher runs the board for us. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner, and our music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.